everyone. Welcome to Curiosity Killed the Cat. We're three curious friends.
That's us.
I'm Christy.
I'm Nash.
I'm Yvette. We'll be talking about all things paranormal, supernatural, creepy, spooky, and anything that makes you say, what the f***? Hey, curious cats. Yvette here. Welcome back to another episode of Curiosity Killed the Cat podcast. This week's episode is a continuation of last week's episode. So if you haven't heard last week's episode, please pause and go check it out. We'll be here waiting for you. If you have heard last week's episode, we will continue with two more stories of alien encounters. So let's jump right in and get back to Naya and Christy. So let's head over to story number three, and this is the story of Terry Lovelace. Terry Lovelace tells his abduction story in his book called The Incident at Devil's Den. His abduction took place in 1977 while he was an EMT and a medic at Whiteman Air Force Base in Western Missouri. He was in the Air Force Base for 6 years, or in the Air Force. He was in the Air Force for 6 years. To provide a little context, Terry claims that he has always had encounters with aliens. He saw a UFO when he was a child, and he ran in his kitchen and told his mom, Mom, I see something out there. But, you know, back then, kids were seen and not heard, so that he was kind of like, get out of here type of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, go.
Yeah, but this one was, like, the big one that, like, takes the cake, this story that I'm about to tell you. He claims that back in 1977, Terry and a fellow friend named Toby, who was also in the Air Force, decided to go camping while they were off duty. Neither of them had ever been camping. They were city boys, so they decided to go and try it out and just try something new, even though Terry was a little hesitant. Terry was an amateur nature photographer and thought that, all right, I'll go to see if I can take some great pictures of, like, the wildlife in the surrounding area. Toby, Terry's friend, was an avid amateur astronomer, and he loved being outdoors, and he loved looking at the night sky. He can tell when there was a satellite going to pass by. He could name different stars and all that stuff. So that's what he loved to do. So they figured, what the heck, let's go. 45 minutes surrounding the base in Missouri, there was about a dozen campgrounds that they could have gone to. But Toby kept insisting, no, let's go to Devil's Den, which was about a 6-hour drive away from the base. It was in Arkansas.
Oh, that's
a
long drive.
Yeah, so they had to cross state lines. Toby convinced Terry to go to Devil's Den because he said, like, forget the campgrounds. There's going to be a bunch of kids, a bunch of hippies smoking weed.
Mama knows how.
Yeah, Devil's Den is the perfect wilderness adventure. It's, you know, it's like a conservation. Mm-hmm. So there's no camping allowed. It's going to be dark, no
but
city lights. They were going to sneak into it, girl.
Oh.
Yeah. So once they arrived to the Devil's Den, they made sure to avoid the rangers because there was absolutely no camping in the area. They parked their vehicle on a, like, dirt road off the major highway, and they hiked up through the restricted area that was kept private to preserve some of the wildlife in that area. They climbed up to this point, like the highest point that they could find, like in the clearing, and they were on top of like a meadow. They could see like a meadow, and it was clear. What I want you guys to know is that Devil's Den supposedly is held to be like among local Indian tribes in the area. It's largely avoided by them because it has a reputation of attracting darkness based on what the Indian tribes say.
I'm sorry, but I would no, but sometimes when you go camping there's funky names like that.
Yeah like I used to go to this place called Devil's Punch Bowl, but it was just like a hiking, it was just like a waterfall and like a little thing, but
yeah,
it's like
I think
Devil's Punch Bowl just to sound creepy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But when the Indians, like the Native Americans from that have been here for so many years, to me that's a red flag.
Yeah, totally.
I would totally take that and be like, okay,
if they don't go, I ain't going.
Not. Yes.
So
yeah.
If Native Indians told you that Black Star is really bad, you would stop going?
I've never been there.
Oh, I think.
What about Peter's Canyon? They're like, it's a Indian burial ground, girl.
That was this.
No, I don't think I would stop going. Indian burial ground? It probably was.
What if they avoid it?
Oh, maybe.
You were still going?
Well, no, nothing's ever happened to me. But I would, like, okay, they've never been there. Yeah, I think I'd be more cautious. Especially a place like that. Like, there's nobody around.
Yeah.
I think I do get a little more comfort when it's somewhere. People go, hundreds of people go every weekend.
Yeah, this place was completely blocked off.
But if it's in the middle of nowhere, like, no, I'm good.
Yeah, this place was blocked off. So the men took a long hike, like I said, to up to the meadow. They set up camp and then they decided to go explore. And when they came back, they fell asleep beneath like a tree. Then they awoke just before it got really dark. And they scurried back to their campsite and they like blew up their little individual air mattresses. And they set up tent, the usual stuff you do when you're going to have camp. You have your campfire, you're eating, and then you just start relaxing and they begin talking. Mm-hmm. So in the middle of their conversation, Toby turns over to Terry and he says, "Hey, were those lights there before?" And he gestures over.
Oh no, I gotta go home.
Yeah, and he gestures over towards the light over Terry's shoulder. They could see three moving lights in the shape of a triangle on the horizon. And the lights were just kind of like dancing around, but they maintain like that triangle shape. And they begin acting strangely. The lights begin moving up, down, rotating. Both men thought that this was really cool.
Oh, what were they on?
Girl, I don't even know.
In the 70s?
My first thought would have been that it's the Rangers.
With triangular lights?
No, just like with flashlights.
No, but it was in the sky.
Oh, okay.
They saw the three triangular lights in the sky on the horizon, moving up and down and rotating. So
he's like, someone's been giving us a light show.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, Terry states that he felt an incredible stillness and calm wash over him. His eyes still looking at the lights, he asked his friend, "Toby, are you scared?" And he says, "No, I'm not scared." Both of them still just looking at the lights, not even looking at each other. So then all of a sudden, the lights moved and Terry noticed that it was a large object that was in between the lights. The lights began approaching them.
Oh, no.
And then the lights, he saw that in between the lights, whatever it was blocking out the stars. So he realized like, oh, shit, like this thing is huge. The object then flew over the meadow and it stopped and a large beam of light came down. Terry describes this kind of like a bright searchlight. So it lit up everything in the meadow. The light bounced off and on around the meadow like it was like as if it was just checking different spots. Like it would turn on over here, then for 3 seconds and turn on over here. It was just bouncing, dancing around the meadow. Just the spotlight was just moving.
No way.
Yeah. And then the light began to have a purple glow bouncing around. And then the purple glow turned into a laser beam, turning off and on, dancing around the campsite where they were. He said that the laser struck him. It didn't hurt him. It struck like the trees. It struck his friend, the fire. He said there was no pain and there was no anxiety and that this lasted around 3 minutes and then it went away. He said as soon as it was over, his friend said, "Okay, show's over, time for bed." And Toby thought, okay, like that's not normal, man. In his mind, he thought, that's not normal.
Yeah, like
what did we just see?
Exactly.
His friend didn't even talk about it. They both were sharing a tent. They both dragged their air mattress in their tent, and they just fell asleep.
What would you do, girl?
No,
if I talked you into camping.
Ya ves, pendeja, this is why.
Isn't that weird for someone to just be like, oh?
That's what I'm
maybe
saying.
Trying
like
to be brave and like trying to be like, okay, well, let's move
or
on.
Or maybe you were on something, but I feel like when you're on something, you're more likely to creep out.
I can see Christy laughing nervously. laughing and then crying.
I would be like, no, bitch, you can't go to sleep right now.
Confessions. One of us ain't getting out of here.
Yeah, no, I'd be like, no, there's no going to bed right now, bro. We need to talk about this. Like, what the hell is going on?
We need to talk about this. What are we going to be doing? Calm down, Yvette.
What did you see?
Tell me that, then I'm like, okay, I gotta go to bed.
No, I'd be like, what did you see? Did we see the same thing? And am I tripping? Like, are we saw the same thing, right? Yes? Okay, fine. I just want to make sure I'm not fucking crazy.
And then we say goodnight, girl.
Yeah, good night. That's fine. Oh. So Terry states that he was so tired after this, the lights, that he even fell asleep with his shoes on. He didn't even bother taking them on because he just felt that exhausted. Terry awoke.
I thought because he would be ready to run.
No, he was just that exhausted. Like he just they just knocked out. Terry awoke about what he thinks is about 4 hours later. When he woke up, he was confused and he had forgotten that he was camping. He noticed that his watch was no longer working and it stopped at 2:15 a.m. He then looks up from his watch and he notices that the tent is being illuminated, like, and being lit by some type of lights. The lights were white, green, and yellow. So he could see this light, these lights outside of his tent. He thought the park rangers, shoot, were busted.
Right.
He also heard a large noise that sounded like a generator. And he looked over to his friend to see if he was awake. And he sees his friend was awake, kneeling and peering out a small flap from the tent. He noticed that there were tears running down his friend's face. And this was not like Toby. Toby was always stoic. He always kept it together. Yeah. So for him to see his grown friend had tears on his face, he
kind of freaked out.
Yeah, he went over to him and asked him, "What, Toby? What is it? Is it the park rangers?" Toby gives him the universal be quiet look with the finger over his lip and whispers, "They're still out there." Terry, still confused from the sleep that he just awoke from and his friend's odd behavior, he looks out the flap and sees what he thinks are kids in the meadow.
Oh, fuck no.
He then asks Toby, "What are the kids doing out here?" Toby says, "Man, those ain't no kids. They took us. They hurt us. Don't you remember?" As soon as he said that, Terry instantly got flashbacks of what had just happened to him. He says that the kids, or the human, the non-human beings, walked as the ones that he was watching through the flap. He said that he noticed that they walked with a wide gait, and they all were dressed identical. They all had gray jumpsuits with boots, and they all had long arms that were longer than their legs.
Oh my God, how creepy.
Yeah. So they were all, it looked like they were exploring the place. He said he noticed them walking around, looking around, picking up flowers, picking up dirt. He claims that the searchlight came on the craft all of a sudden, and all of the aliens headed towards the beam of light. And once they went under the beam of light, they dissolved into it. So Terry remembers being taken inside an enormous craft through an intense beam of light. They witnessed dozens of other humans already undergoing tests as different forms of alien life oversaw the physical examinations on these humans. He heard a woman screaming in pain, and he said it wasn't just like a normal scream of pain. He said this was like a blood-curdling scream, like pain. He also remembers his friend screaming in pain, yelling, "Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!" He states that he was laying on a table and this praying mantis looking creature approached him, and he said he tried to scream as loud as he could, but no noise would come out. He said in his mind he could hear himself yelling as loud as he could, but no sound would come out. The praying mantis looking alien then hits him on the head and with his telepathic spidey sense or whatever tells him, "Why are you screaming? We're not going to hurt you. Stop screaming." He said he never said anything verbally with sound, but it came out like it was telepathically transferred to him.
No.
Yeah. Imagine like this alien green insect coming at you. Oh, no. Thank
Skitty
you.
Skitty and leaf looking. With,
telling you to calm down.
With big eyes telling you to calm
down.
Both men's lives were profoundly changed that night, and It prompted Lovelace, Terry, to realize that he and Toby had experienced an abduction that night. And the creatures were out of this world and perhaps not of this dimension. So they returned to their tent and they fled in a panic at 3 a.m. And they, once they arrived to the base, they were repeatedly and insistently questioned by military authorities and they got hospitalized. They were hospitalized because he noticed once they arrived to base that he and Toby had suffered some type of like sunburn. Okay. Throughout their bodies, their eyeballs, their eyes, as I don't know if you guys know, like if welders don't wear those, their things, yes, yes, yes. They burn their eyes, mm-hmm. And they had those type of welders type things on their eyes.
So that's how they were like, okay, you guys come here, we need to speak to
you. Like what's going on? He said that he was in his, once he arrived at the hospital on the base, an OSI agent, which stands for official officer special investigation, like there was an OSI agent and a man that he had never seen before walked into Terry's room and they demanded to know what he had seen and what happened.
No.
They asked Terry to hand over any video or or pictures that he had taken, and it just so happens that Terry actually forgot his camera. So he was gonna over here, like a mental, take pictures, but he didn't even have his camera.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he went for on hike. Never forget it. He went hiking.
Are you forgetting your camera?
Yeah, so he didn't have anything to show them, you know? And yeah. Toby and him both, like, had no proof. The mysterious man that showed up with the OSI agent said that he knew what him and Toby had seen. And he told them that if they shared the story with anyone or if they had proof that of this incident, that they were going to regret it.
Dude, that's so fucked up. So what a mind fuck. What was going on in there?
Yeah, that's why they blocked it off.
Yeah. So after the hospitalization. Girl, they were threatened.
Traumatic yeah. experience. And then you're told if you ever open your mouth, like, fuck. What?
Yeah, they were threatened.
I get it. You're not gonna probably not gonna open your mouth, but within you, like that's gonna fuck.
Yeah, with. And he said he had never seen that man, and he's never seen him since. Oh my God. That man that walked in the room with him,
in black,
probably
something,
because that man knew exactly what he saw and exactly what had happened to him. Mm-hmm. But he's like, only Toby and I were there. I don't know how he knew everything that happened.
It's probably happened before.
Probably. Mm-hmm. After the hospitalization, Terry and Toby were ordered to never contact each other ever again. Not by a third party, not by their wives, nothing. So I have a
clip. They weren't allowed to be friends anymore?
No, they weren't allowed to be friends anymore. And I have a clip so you guys can hear coming from Terry in his own words what they told him about contacting Toby.
What they did was they separated us. Toby and I, they separated us and kept us apart. And we were ordered to have no contact with one another.
I think when they don't do what they're supposed to or keep it quiet is when they ruin the people's reputation.
The like careers? The,
yeah, like the people, like the police officers or whoever will say, you know, he was in the crazy house for 3 months before this incident.
Yeah, you know, they pull out your criminal record and all that. But can you imagine going through this experience and then for them to tell you, you can't even make eye contact with this person. Like, that's never again. Up. Yeah.
I don't like that. That's
so after the incident and after being given orders to never contact each other again, Terry drove by Toby's house and his wife, Sheila, was driving. And he told her, just please, let's go. I need to see him. And she said, no, we were absolutely not allowed to go see him. And Terry said that he knew he had been given orders, but he just needed to go and reach out to Toby one last time. Terry goes, knocks on the door. Toby's wife answers and says, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. And he says, I know. I just need to see Toby one last time. As he thinks Toby heard him, he comes around the corner and he says that Toby, which is not like him, Toby always dressed pristine, clean, well-shaven, was not shaven, dirty jeans, dirty t-shirt, barefoot, disheveled, and that Toby and Terry just look at each other, and that Toby says, it really did happen, didn't it, Terry? And that Terry just hugged him and said, yes, man, it really did happen. He said he was in there for just 5 minutes, left the house, and that he never saw Toby again. And that 1 week later, Toby and his family got stationed to Japan. Like, they moved him away. So they never had contact with each other ever again. Oh, sorry.
That's so sad. Like, it just totally... It probably made him spiral. Like,
yeah.
Like, that's not
he did. He did spiral. Terry later found out that Toby got a divorce and he developed an alcohol addiction and he never saw him again. Terry became an attorney, assistant attorney general for the state where he lives. And he became close with some FBI agents, you know, a police officer. So he reached out to a trusted FBI agent that he knew back in like 95. And he asked him, hey, I have this friend. Now that I'm not in the military anymore, he thought it would be okay to look for Toby. So he told him this is his dad's name, his dad's address, gave him a little more details. And the FBI agent's like, oh, yeah, I'll find out for you 2 weeks. He says in less than 2 weeks, about a week later, he hits me up and tells me, hey, I'm sorry, your friend died. He passed away. Terry was shocked. He couldn't believe it. Like, damn, like, I never got to say goodbye. And
right.
That's when he found out they told him that he died of, he had developed an alcohol addiction and he got a divorce. So Terry was devastated because he wasn't there to be there for his friend. So later on, he decided to write his book. And he decided, okay, I'm just going to pay my respects. I'm going to look for his obituary and just insert the details here just so I pay my respects to Toby. Well, come to find out that he realized the FBI agent lied to him.
Shut up.
Toby had not died in 95. He actually died in 2007. And he wrote the book in 2016. So this whole time he thought his friend had actually died. They lied to him because... He's like, why would he lie to me? I don't know. He just, it was the cover up. They didn't want us to ever contact each other again. So his friend was alive this whole time. He could have reached out to him.
Yeah.
But then once he decided to do his own research, because back in the 90s, there was no internet.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that. You know what
I
mean?
It wasn't as
Facebook,
simple
Instagram.
Search.
No. So later on, he decided to do his own research because obviously 2016... There was internet, Google, but it was already too late. Toby had already died. I was so sad. So Terry never intended to tell his story or write about this book, but he took up jogging in 2012, and he noticed that every time he hit the 2 mile mark while he was running, there was a place in his knee that would just become numb. It didn't hurt him. It didn't stop him from running. But he just noticed at the 2 mile mark, his knee would go numb. Finally, there was medical tests that revealed an unexplained piece of metal the size of a fingernail implanted in his leg. And it was attached to what appeared to be tiny wires.
What?
Yes. The question became on how this device got implanted in his leg above his knee, where there was no external sign of him having that surgically entered in his body.
Yes.
It hadn't been shrapnel. He hadn't been to war. He was never in active combat. So how did that get in there?
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. So he had never been through surgery, so there was no entrance scar. He couldn't figure it out. A doctor offered to remove it, and when the time for the surgery came and Toby went under, they realized that the implant was no longer in his leg.
No.
No, they took it.
Yeah.
And
that's what he said.
It wasn't there.
That's what he was told, that it was gone. Like, they couldn't find it.
Oh, you mean like they paid the doctor?
Yeah. Since you're going to be there, just take it. It's gone. Just say it was never there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, shoot. I didn't even think of that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Man, this sucks. What a mind fuck.
Isn't it?
Poor man.
Yeah. And, like, he thought he had his friend.
They never stopped watching him.
No. I don't think so. I think they kept tabs on him. Especially
Sounds
because
like
he became, like, the assistant attorney general. He became like a politician type person, you know.
Somebody
what I mean?
That can speak up.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But I think after seeing doing his research and finding out what happened to Toby, and then like this disappearing from his leg when there was clear x-rays where you could clearly see it, I'll post the images on our Instagram account. All of a sudden they, okay, let's take it out, and then it was gone.
Fuck.
Yeah.
How frustrating. Mm-hmm.
I saved the best for last. Are you guys ready?
I'm ready.
Do you have any more questions on the last one?
Man. You guys have any questions on Terry's
That's just
story?
So fucked up. At least that first. Oh, we're gonna talk about the last one.
Why separate them though?
Toby and Terry? They just didn't want them to communicate about the story. Maybe feed each other more
about it,
and then they just shut them down to never share it with anybody. So they just decided to just keep them separate. But
and
then
now
I'm thinking
that he shared it,
but he's out of the Air Force, and then also, but who's gonna believe him?
Me,
because the one person that was there with him is no longer alive.
Fucking FBI agent too.
Yeah, like
you live it yourself.
Yeah, and he's like, I thought this guy was trustworthy, but he lied to me. He's saying that Toby died years earlier when he was still alive at that time.
He had to be trustworthy because he took his word for it.
Yeah,
he didn't go ask another FBI agent. He didn't.
But if you're snooping around and it alerts your boss, and your boss tells you,
yeah, because there's certain there's certain people on certain lists that. I'm sure if you Google, if you research them,
yeah,
it flags.
Bank of America, I used to work there, and they used to say if you type in the information of somebody that's a celebrity, it'll flag your account.
Yeah, because it's classified, confidential. Mm-hmm. I would assume that there's certain people that, especially now with the NSA, how they're able to construct this huge web of your innermost, like, communication, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they know who you talk to, Christy, and they know they can collect like who Melissa talked to, and then Melissa's husband, and like they just create this intricate web of like your innermost circle, and they know, they just go back and back and back, you know.
Well, it would take them like 5 minutes because I have like 3 people in my circle. No, no, this bitch don't got nobody, she's a loner.
But yeah, so that's Terry's story. So let's move on over to the last one, which it's my favorite, and I think you guys are going to love it. It's so good. Okay.
We're ready.
So in December 26th of 1980, U.S. Air Force officials were stationed near the U.K.'s Rendlesham Forest in Suffolk, England, and they noticed lights descending into the Rendlesham Forest. Initially, they thought it was a crashed aircraft, but instead found a landed UFO.
Oh.
Air Force officials on duty, John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, were the officers that arrived first on site where the UFO was. They were the only two that approached the aircraft. Jim Peniston was an experienced Air Force officer with aircrafts, and he absolutely knew this was not of this planet. Both officers had stellar performance reports from their superiors. So there was no reason for them to doubt
what they said
and what they were seeing. Mm-hmm. John and Jim collaborated with Nick Pope, a former British government employee. He worked for the Ministry of Defense, and they wrote a book recounting their incident at the Rendlesham Forest. The following story that I'm going to tell you guys is Jim's story of what happened that night. He said that night he could see a dome of light over the forest, and then multicolored lights inside of the forest, which made him think, okay, this is like a downed aircraft, because he saw the lights and multicolored lights, and he figured, he put them together, and this is what usually occurs when there's an aircraft that goes down. Okay, so Jim and John head out, and they see, okay, once he gets in the forest, he radios and says that this was not a downed aircraft, and he terminates the emergency response on the radio and initiates a helping hand situation, which to the Air Force, this is a possible threat to the base, because this was not an aircraft. It was an unidentified object, and he didn't know if it was enemy. Enemy technology or whatever. He noticed in front of him there was a triangular craft, and at this moment, he didn't know if he was going to come out alive. He claims to feel labored movements as he approached the aircraft. He said he felt as if he was walking in a pool of water the closer he got. Once he was about 10 feet away from the craft, the feeling completely went away. He noticed there was a force field around the craft, and it had like holographic colors. The force field was like holographic surrounding it. When he was finally close enough to touch the aircraft, the force field completely disappeared, and the craft itself was opaque and a little shiny in nature, and he says it looked like black glass. Are you
okay? I'm just envisioning this. Yeah. I'm visioning the aircraft. I'm visiting the hologram.
Like no, Chris, are you looking at Chris?
Christy's like literally.
She's falling asleep.
No, I'm Christy, visioning. You. I put myself in this dream.
With her eyes closed and snoring.
I don't know what face I'm going to make. I'm seriously envisioning. Like, I'm there. Oh, pues.
She's like.
Yeah, she's over here. Okay.
I'm serious. Okay, I'm gonna tell you guys something, and I'm gonna ask my siblings in, because I remember when we were kids, they talked about this, but I was too young. We used to live in Santa Ana.
Uh-huh.
We moved to like Westminster.
Yeah.
When I was, I think, close to 3 or 4.
Okay.
Okay. And they had said that there was a UFO like figure where the apartments are, coming down, and it had rainbow lights.
Oh, shoot.
And they said that they all went out like, oh, shit. Like, they all went out to see it, like, through the window or I don't know what the fuck.
Yeah.
But they, I don't remember. And I remember it coming up years ago, and they're like, yeah, you were too little. You're not going to remember.
Ooh.
I don't know if they were fucking with me, like, now that you're saying it.
Yeah.
But now that you're saying it, you're like, the rainbow thing, that's why I started envisioning, oh, pues, my cara de pendeja. I'm over here looking like a
one eye was closed, one eye was open, girl. I don't even know.
You're stupid.
Sir, you were like.
I was trying to envision, like, oh, my God, my siblings talked about this.
Oh, we're going to have to ask them. We'll insert our convo with them and ask.
All right, ladies, let's get this on show on the road. Yeah, so the craft itself was opaque and shiny in nature, and to him it looked like black glass. The craft was well lit underneath, and there was no seams, rivets, or bolts, or any type of landing gear that he could find or see with his eyes. Mm-hmm. Both officers walked around the craft, and they noticed that there was no flaps, intake, exhaust. It was void of all the things that you would normally see on an aircraft, or that they would see on an aircraft, because they were in the Air Force. So they were looking for things that would...
Something they would recognize.
They would recognize, and they couldn't. Jim noticed that there was a glowing hieroglyphic-type markings on etched on the aircraft, on the top of the aircraft. The writing stretched out about 3 feet wide, and he said that the glyphs were about 5 or 6 inches high. So it was like 3 feet wide, like probably as long as max, and then three like this tall.
Okay.
Once Jim and John returned to base, they turned in their OSI reports, which Jim said his report was about 4 pages long. But some investigators have tried looking for this 4-page report that he says that he wrote, but there's no report. There's only one page, and it's about 3 to 4 paragraphs. And Jim says that you're never gonna find this report, and he has a perfectly good explanation. He says once he arrived and he submitted his OSI report, he was ordered to change it or else. They came to Jim with a 1-page report that
superiors
came. And it was 3 to 4 paragraphs, and the story was completely different from what he originally reported. He was ordered to sign and say that he never touched the craft and that he remained 50 feet away from it at all times. He said that the man that spoke to him was not an OSI agent, and just like in Terry's case, he had never seen this man before, and he never saw this man after the incident.
And he said what was different, and he knew this man was not in the Air Force or an OSI agent, because this man was in a suit, and this was not like them. They didn't wear suits. So Jim states that he went along with the one-page report that they had him sign, because he just didn't want them, like you said, Naye, for them to derail his career. Mm-hmm. He wanted to keep his career intact, so he just went along with it. And he just kept his mouth quiet. So 2 days after Jim and John's incident, the base was having a Christmas celebration. Keep in mind, this event happened on December 26th. So Jim's event happened December 26th, 1980. So a few days late, 2 days later, they were having a late Christmas celebration on base. And a young officer comes up to the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Halt, and says, "Sir, it's back." The colonel is a by-the-book type of guy, and he had heard rumors of this incident the first time that it happened 2 days prior. Mm-hmm. And he was not impressed. And now that the rumors were swirling on base, he thought, okay, I'm going to go out there and put a team together, and I'm going to debunk this. Everyone needs to get back and doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, enough of this. So Colonel Charles grabbed his tape recorder, which was his custom. He always carried it. He would record memos throughout of what would happen throughout the day so he can write his reports in the evening, just so he could keep track of what was happening on what day. So he heads out with his little recorder and his team, and they go and check out these lights because supposedly it's back. He goes out into the forest. And I'll insert a clip.
Watch, throw the head off my flash right there, sir. Oh, there it is.
Hey, I see it too.
What is it?
We don't know, sir.
So, yeah, can I get some room? Yeah, it's a strange, small red light. You'll see that maybe a quarter to half mile, maybe further out. I'm gonna switch off. The light is gone now. It was approximately 120 degrees from the site. Yeah. Is it back again?
Yes, sir.
Everything else is just deathly calm. There is no doubt about it. There's some type of strange flashing red light ahead.
There's yellow.
And I saw a yellow tinge in it, too. Weird. It appears that you may be moving a little bit this way. It's brighter than past that.
Yellow.
It's coming this way. Also, it is definitely coming this way. Pieces of it are shutting off. There is no doubt about it. This is weird.
Upon entering the forest to investigate what they were seeing, according to Halt's memo, they described a glowing object, metallic in appearance, with colored lights. Kind of what Christy saw. Mm-hmm. As they attempted to approach the object, it appeared to move through the trees, and the animals on the nearby farm were going into a frenzy. They were just barking, howling. They were just going nuts. Halt states in his memo that the object was moving away from him and his team, and it was shedding a molten-like metal that was causing sparks. It then exploded into several white balls, and they all took off. Like, the material just took off into the night sky.
What?
Yeah.
That, like, the pieces?
Yeah, it was melting into, like, these, like, it was, the UFO was shedding, like, it was shedding, like, metal. Mm-hmm. But he said it wasn't, like, flying pieces. Like, it was, like, liquid metal. Like, it was shedding. And then it exploded into several white balls of light. Mm-hmm. And then they just flew into the night sky. Like, it just broke off into a whole bunch of pieces.
And they all went together.
Yeah, and they all took off. So it went from one large piece to several, and they took off. Okay. The servicemen near the clearing at the eastern edge of the forest saw the craft land, and there, when they saw the craft land and take off, they approached where the craft was, and they found three small impressions on the ground in a triangular pattern, as well as burn mark and broken branches on the nearby trees. They took radiation readings in the triangle impressions on the ground, and they noticed peak readings of radiation emanating from that area where the craft had landed. The colonel and his team were stunned. They couldn't explain what this was. They returned back to base, and Halt submitted his memo along with tapes and pictures of what they saw, like the indentations and the broken branches. The government concluded that some of the servicemen did suffer from radiation exposure.
Oh.
Force officer John Burrow, he was the officer that was with Jim Peniston, was there. He was one, him and Jim were the first ones that approached. He actually was awarded a full payout for being exposed to radiation during the events in Rendlesham Forest.
Dang.
They paid him money.
That's it.
Yeah, because he sued because he was getting really sick. Mm-hmm. So, for Senator John McCain, who's no longer alive, RIP, he got involved in this issue. And he demanded that the Air Force pay John Burrow, compensate him for being exposed to the radiation of this UFO incident. Mm-hmm. Senator John McCain's coordinator, chief coordinator assistant, actually reached out to John and recorded the conversation and let him know, hey, John McCain's pushing for you. He's going to make sure that you're taken care of. And if not, he's going to take it to the Senate. Like, he was pushing, and John Burrow was...
He was going
to expose it. And he was, like, shocked that John McCain knew who he was, and he was actually fighting for him to get compensated for the radiation exposure that he was experiencing. So all of these records were for UKI government employees only, but they are now declassified, and people can now go and publicly see for your own eyes all of these documents, listen to the tape recordings from Colonel Holt that he took on his tape recorder. So Jim kept quiet for years. Jim and John, as I said, were the first two officers that were present when the craft initially first landed. Jim kept quiet for years, and he retired with a great career, but he decided that it was time for him to come clean about what he really saw that night. So Jim, up until now, didn't say anything until he collaborated with John on his book. He said that he approached the craft and he saw the glyphs etched on the craft, and he ran his fingers over the hieroglyphics that he saw, and he felt a jolt come from the craft. And he saw the glyphs begin to light up. He said all he could see in his mind as he touched the hieroglyphics on the craft, a matrix-looking binary code of ones and zeros. For those of you who don't know what a binary code is, it's a number system that's only made up of two numbers, one and zero. It's used to write data such as, like, for computer processing. That's what it's used for. And I figured, they say numbers is a universal language.
Yeah.
So that's like, no matter if you're in the United States or in Japan, numbers, everybody understands, whether it's a one, a two, or three, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So he's receiving this download of ones and zeros. He goes home and he just keeps seeing the sequence of numbers in his mind.
Oh, crap.
So he decides to write them down, and he said that as he was writing them down, he felt that heaviness lift from him as he continued to write it down, because he could see the number sequences clearly. So it's like 1001, blah 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 blah. So he wrote it all down in a notebook. The download, the vision, that memory completely went away. He tucked the notebook out, like he tucked it away, and he drew out the hieroglyphics, and he just never saw it again. Then 30 years later,
what did he feel, that writing it would make it go away?
It made it go away. It, like, kind of eased. It worked.
It almost like he downloaded into paper. Form.
Yeah, like he transferred it from his mind to a notebook. And he just felt completely at ease. He was no longer, like seeing it. So he said he wrote it down, jotted it down in his notebook, drew the hieroglyphics, and then he just tucked it away. 30 years later, he was being asked about this Rendlesham Forest incident. And someone's asking him, hey, what do the glyphs look like? Do you know? He's like, oh, well, I actually drew them down, like wrote them down. And he pulled out his notebook. And as he's showing this person, the flipping through the notebook, he's like, whoa, 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 what's that? And he's like, oh, that's the download that I received. He's like, okay, forget the glyphs. What is this? And he's like, well, it's just the sequence I kept seeing. So the person that's asking him tells him, we need to take this to, like, someone who has knowledge of binary code and see what the sequence says, the messages.
Oh my God.
So they take the binary code to a computer programmer who has no idea of the incident, and that he has no prior knowledge to Jim or anything. He translates the message, and here's what the message said. You ready? Exploration of humanity continuous for planetary advance. Eyes of our eyes, origin year 8100. That's what the message said. It also included latitude and longitude coordinates to several locations on Earth, and these locations have long thought to be important sites or like world wonders. Here is what they were, the longitude coordinates, okay?
Oh my God. Oh my God, I'm excited.
Okay, one is the pyramids of Egypt. The other one is the Nazca lines in Peru, and those are the lines, kind of like crop circles, but they're indentations in the ground. They don't know how they got there, but they're saying maybe extraterrestrial, so that's another right. one. The other one is the Temple of Apollo in Greece. And the last one is coordinates to an island called High Brazil, which is an island that existed many, many years ago. And it can be found in historical maps, but it's no currently...
It's underground. It's underwater?
It's underwater. It's no longer above ground. And it's known as the Celtic Atlantis. For Jim, when he found this out, he was blown away. Because how would he know about this island? It's not on any globe or map that you can easily pull out of your butt and be like, oh, hi, Brazil. This island's right here. It's a tiny, tiny little island. So it's just like, what do they mean by exploration of humanity and origin year 8100, right? So Jim firmly believes that this craft was an interdimensional... that this craft was interdimensional, and that this wasn't aliens, that this was actually us from the future trying to send us a message.
No.
Yeah, he thinks that we were able to access interdimensional travel, and that we came back from the year 8100 to try to give us a message.
8100 though?
Mm-hmm. Well, think about the message. It says exploration of humanity continues for planetary advancement. Eyes of our eyes. Origin 8100. And why would it include these really, like, obviously well known locations, mm-hmm. important yeah. sites? Like, obviously, everyone knows, like, the pyramids of Egypt, they're so controversial. Like, they say, they couldn't have done it on their own. Why were they in a triangle shape? Why, also the Aztecs had, and the Mayans had pyramids. Why is it that they had these pyramids? Why not just square buildings or whatever? Like,
that is true.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, ladies, that's all I have for you guys today.
Oh, my God. What a mind fuck.
Yeah, I think it could be us.
From the future.
From the future. Like maybe warning us. Like, if you think about the Egyptians, right? That's a gone civilization.
Mm-hmm.
The Greece, you know, in Greece, the temples, the gods, like, they're no longer around. This island, it's not around. Maybe it's a warning. A warning of, I don't know, like, planetary advancement. But you know how they say that there's technology that we're just finding out, like, it exists, mm-hmm. but the government's been working on it for years?
Oh, for sure. When GPS came out, I mean...
They already had that. So that's old school for them, but it's new for us. And we're like, oh, my God.
Right.
But they're working on shit that it's going to blow our minds when it first comes out. And to them, it's going to be old news. Like, psh, we've been using this on you guys for years.
Yeah.
Little did you guys know. You know what I mean?
Man, that shit trips me out. The decoding?
The binary code?
Yeah.
Yeah, but though I tried researching and it's a mindfuck. I was like, wait, what? It's like, this number takes the place of this and it doubles in value of that. And I'm like, how the fuck do you break that down?
Yeah. Same.
And it's like, yeah. why... obviously numbers, it's a universal language. That's smart, like, for you to send a message like that. But if for him to get it, write it down in that sequence for it to explain exactly, to give you that message, how would he know that? I don't even, I wouldn't be able
to. For it to make sense.
For it to make sense.
If it's blue, table, yellow, you know, just random gibberish.
Exactly. And in the sequence that he wrote it in, it was just right.
And in actual locations.
In actual longitude and latitude locations.
Can you imagine? Man, I just can't imagine if we were being communicated from people, from something from the future.
Why not? Oh no.
Yeah.
Well, I really hope you guys enjoyed this episode, ladies.
This was a tough one, but it was really good. But
yes.
It
really does.
Please rate, review, subscribe, and share with your friends.
I'm excited. I'm excited to hear your thoughts on this one, guys.
Yes, I'm gonna upload all the pictures, all the clips. So you guys can see, it's, I have pictures of Jim's journal, his notebook, of the code and the drawings. It's mind-blowing.
And if you've ever been abducted, please make sure to share with us.
Oh, yeah. Let us interview.
Yeah, we want to know. Thanks, guys.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye. Hey guys, just wanted to update you that we have our email and IG up and running. Please send your comments and suggestions to thecuriouscatpod@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram @curiouscatpodcast.
Please rate, review, subscribe, and tell a friend.
Stay curious, and remember, curiosity killed the cat. Wow.